ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Marine life washes up dead on South Australian shores. This time it's locals from the idyllic Kangaroo Island raising concerns.
Now, I took a few photos over the last few days of like the dead cuttlefish and pufferfish, etc. It's just got increasingly worse.
It comes less than a fortnight after a large-scale fish kill on Fluorio Peninsula beaches, where the EPA identified a toxic microalgae bloom. And how a heart transplant for a woman in Taree on the New South Wales North Coast has transformed her life.
You swim and you get to the end and you're not gasping for air and you think, oh, wow, is this what it feels like for people?
I'm Alex Barwick and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Aranda Country in Alice Springs and Buntua, bringing you stories from across regional and remote Australia. First, let's head to southwest Queensland. More images and stories are coming in from the 500,000 square kilometres of southwest Queensland devastated by flooding. Footage from the small town of Thargaminda shows the main street looking more like a muddy river, and most buildings are partially engulfed in water as debris floats through. The whole town has evacuated to higher ground, some flown out to nearby towns. There are also stories of rescue emerging. A 29-year-old man stranded for 2 days in the outback after his car was bogged was found and is now in hospital.
There was the word help written in the mud on the road with some arrows pointing to where the missing person was.
The word catastrophic is being used to describe stock losses. So far, more than 150,000 livestock are missing or dead. Our Long Reach reporter Grace Nakamura has the latest. Grace, good to speak to you. Is there still rain falling in these affected areas?
Hi, Alex. Yes, there's been a bit more rain overnight. About 150 millimetres fell around Tambo, which is in the central west. And so far, the towns of Tambo and Blackall haven't been severely inundated. But one of the concerns is now that that water has fallen around Tambo, it'll move through those river catchments once again and will reach Longreach. And in Longreach at the moment, the river is in a major flood. It's not a massive concern at the moment, but then that water will again still move through the rivers onto Junda. And Junda's one of the towns where people were evacuated last week and water went through the entire town. That water has now receded mostly. And the mayor said earlier today that because that water has gone down a little bit, they're not overly concerned. But there's also been some further rainfall to the south in those towns like Thargaminda and Quilpie, which, as we've been hearing over the last few days, have been totally inundated. And it's very rare for outback residents to say, but a lot of them are telling us no more. We don't want any more rain at this point, just because of the devastation it's caused over the last week.
And a lot of people are in no way out of the woods. I know a lot of residents are still unable to return to their homes. How are people doing that are currently evacuated?
The first residents to be flown out were the residents of Ada Vale, which is a small town near Quilpie. They were flown out last Thursday, so it's been nearly a week now. They've been staying at the Quilpie Motor Inn. I spoke to one of the residents a few hours ago, and she was saying that it was just terrifying. The evacuation itself was quite distressing, as you can imagine, seeing water go through your homes and knowing that for your own safety, you need to leave your home behind. And she says for the past week, they've been dealing with the emotional fallout of, you know, leaving your home, not knowing if your belongings have made it. Fortunately, many of their pets were able to be flown out as well, but she says it's been a really difficult week for them. Fortunately as well, though, the people in Quilpie have really rallied around them. They've been supplying them with food, clothing. Tonight they're meeting for a home-cooked meal, which I'm sure will be much appreciated. And residents in the town of Junda, they were also flown out a few days ago. A lot of them are here in Longreach at the moment. And so there's been disaster recovery assistance for them as well. So the people who have evacuated, it's certainly been a bit of an uncertain time. They're just waiting to see what that impact will be on their homes, on their livelihoods. But until that water goes down further, they're just unable to get back.
It's hard to grasp what the magnitude of stock loss actually means for families and their businesses. What is the latest?
Yeah, Alex, well, we spoke to the Minister of Primary Industries, Tony Perrott, this morning. He came in with the Premier to Longreach. And the latest figures we've had from this morning, that is that 150,000, which is cattle, goats and sheep that are either deceased now or are missing, likely to have been deceased. And this is from 92 disaster surveys. But as we've said, that number is expected to rise once the water goes down and people are actually able to go out and see just how much stock they've lost. So for some people, that's, you know, 10% of their stock. Others have lost more like 100% of their stock. So that is truly devastating for the families who have centered their entire livelihoods on agriculture, on having cattle, sheep, goats, whatever it be. That's going to impact their business and their income for a long time to come.
Some farmers and graziers have flagged the need for more weather radars and river gauges in the region. What's been said?
One of the tricky things about being so far, being so remote, is just the geographical distance that you have to cover. So, like I said, this is about 500,000 square kilometres of land in Queensland. And despite that, the population here is only in the tens of thousands, not in the hundreds of thousands. So the tricky thing is being able to measure what the river gauges are and just like how much rain has fallen when you've got so much land to cover. So one of the massive problems that's arisen from this weather event is that there isn't a weather gauge, a radar between, I think, around from Quilpie through to Alice Springs. So that's a massive chunk of Queensland where they don't have a radar. They're not able to really tell what's coming. And the Quilpie Mayor, Ben Hall, has actually flagged this as a problem, and they've been campaigning to get a radar there for quite some time. Here's what he said a few days ago.
We have no radar, bomb radar, from here to Alice Springs. So it's a huge swath of the state. We're not able to observe what weather event is coming or is passing over us. I mean, there was plenty of warning that there was an event coming, but as to, you know, what actually falls and when and where, to give some indication of levels coming through, you know, for people to know exactly where they're at. We're not seeing enough valuable data for us to actually work off.
Quilpie Mayor Ben Hall speaking there. And finally, Grace, we're hearing that it's chopper pilots who've been incredibly helpful through all of this.
Yeah, Alex, well, as you know, all of the roads, many of the roads in and out of these outback towns are cut at the moment. They've gone under. A lot of them in the first place were dirt roads, so they'll be unable to be travelled on for quite some time, which means the only way to get in and out of a lot of these towns is by air, which is why the chopper pilots have really been the heroes of this event. These are people on properties who've got their own choppers, or even parts of businesses, or, you know, local aerial assets. They've flown in some of the Defence Force choppers as well. And these pilots, a lot of them are volunteering their own time and their own money to fly fodder or fuel onto remote isolated properties. They're helping out in a huge way, dropping in extra food supplies, clean water, as well as clothes, that sort of thing. So while the residents of these towns are stranded essentially in what are more like islands at the moment than outback towns, it's really been the choppers who have been helping get supplies and communications out and about.
Grace, thanks so much.
Thank you.
As you just heard reporter Grace Nakamura say, this is a part of the world where graziers are usually praying for rain, but now many are wishing it away after such devastating floods. Reporter Madeline McCosker has compiled these stories from the communities affected across southwest Queensland.
It caught many by surprise.
All the stock we did move, we were already moving in water by the time they forecast these really big falls of rain.
More than 1,000 kilometres due west of Queensland's famous Noosa beaches, grazier Brendan Murray is dealing with his own inland sea. At Erromanga in the state's southwest, the forecast was for 100 millimetres over 7 days. It quickly became almost 2 years' worth of rain in half that time.
About 100 mils of rain, we would have been happy to leave the stock where they were, really. And waited out, but the forecast just kept going up and up and up. But we actually got 2 years of rain in 3 days. We got 450 mils.
The scale was staggering. An area twice the size of Victoria has been inundated for more than a week. whole farms and communities consumed by relentless water. The rain system was widespread and slow-moving. Towns and properties thousands of kilometres apart went under. While the system was slow, the emergency moved quickly. Towns like Adavale and Junda, south of Longreach, were evacuated as water rushed through homes. Thargaminda, in the southwest corner of Queensland, remains on high alert as the Bulloo River continues to rise to levels not seen in decades. Voluntary evacuations to Charleville began on Tuesday, neighbours taking in those fleeing their flood-ravaged homes. At Piccarilli Station, southwest of Thargaminda, Anthony Glasson opened his home to evacuees, even as 20,000 hectares of his own property was submerged.
Yeah, we've sort of just put out the offer to people in town that they can come out here if they want to. The plan we're sort of working on to get them choppered over the river and we can pick them up. And yeah, there'll be just a small group of young fellows coming home here. They've been busy the last few days helping in town where they can, lifting stuff onto higher ground and moving the hospital out to the aerodrome and that sort of thing. But it's sort of to a point in town there now where there's not much, there's nothing the town can do now. It's just a waiting game. We've got beds here between houses and quarters. We could pull up to 25 people. Our biggest issue will be food. If we ended up with that many people, we've got plenty of meat, but that's an issue we could resolve, no doubt. I think a lot of people aren't going to want to leave, even if they're sleeping up at the airport in swags and tents, etc., which I completely understand. Their whole loss just down the road there. There'll be a lot of people who'll probably just sit it out and wait.
Communities rushed to prepare, but in towns like Thargaminda and Yulo, they were flying blind. A lack of river gauges in the Bulloo and Paroo river systems meant no one really knew just how much water was coming. The only gauge upstream of Thargaminda was washed away in floodwaters before the peak was due to hit the town. In Queensland, most floods are measured against the 1974 disaster, one of the most significant and deadly weather events in the state's history. In 1974, the flood peak in the Bulloo hit 6.78 metres. Locals and the Weather Bureau estimate this time it's held steady at the 7.5 metre mark. In between all these small, isolated communities are hundreds of thousands of hectares of grazing land, home to millions of cattle, sheep and goats. More than 144,000 head are believed to have perished in the floods or in the aftermath from exposure. That number is expected to grow in the coming days, weeks and months. Emily Green is from a property near Adavale, but was in Mount Isa when disaster struck. She had to watch through her phone as her home, her community and her livelihood washed away.
The water's starting to recede and we're starting to see the boneyards of our communities and our properties. It's been incomprehensible to see the extent of the damage caused. It's been multi-million dollars worth of infrastructure as well as livestock and homes that have just been washed up and discarded. Thank goodness for our local legends that are using their own helicopters and machinery to build levee banks, drop food to cattle, get people out of there. It's been a huge community effort and thank goodness for that, or we would have been pretty buggered. It's been absolutely tormenting to all of us to remember and recognise the stock that we couldn't protect and that ended up succumbing to Mother Nature herself. You know, they've come out of the driest of times, these animals. There's thousands of sheep, horses, cattle that have toughed out a pretty serious drought and now they're not going to get to see the green grass growing.
That's Emily Green. She's from a property near Adavale in Western Queensland, ending that report from Madeline McCosker, with additional reporting from Hannah Walsh and Grace Nakamura. And the government has confirmed that the number of livestock killed or missing from the disaster has and will continue to rise. South of the Queensland border, dozens of schools have closed in northwest New South Wales as communities prepare for significant flash flooding. The Department of Education closed schools in Narrabri, Weewaw and surrounding areas today. The State Emergency Service is warning around 350 people living through the Warrego and Paroo River catchments are at risk of isolation for up to 6 weeks as floodwaters make their way south from Queensland. Andrew Edmonds from the SES says there's also a separate flood watch for parts of the state's mid-north coast, northern rivers and northwest slopes.
Well, we may see 40 to 100 millimetres of rain which could lead to obviously flash flooding and also riverine flooding, given how wet the catchments are following Cyclone Alfred.
Do stay listening to ABC Local Radio for all the latest information. Let's head to South Australia now, where locals from the idyllic Kangaroo Island are concerned about the amount of marine life washing up dead on local beaches. It comes less than a fortnight after a large-scale fish kill on Fluorio Peninsula beaches, about an hour south of Adelaide, where the EPA identified a toxic microalgae bloom. Vicky Natafalis reports.
Kangaroo Islanders are reporting dead fish and other marine creatures washing onto local beaches, less than a fortnight after a similar event on the Fluorio Peninsula. Senior naturalist and local tour guide, Nikki Redman, says she regularly visits D'Estrys Bay to collect rubbish on the beach and has seen dead creatures most days since March 22. One of those days, she says 100-plus dead animals were on the shore.
I regularly go down and do rubbish pickups at D'Estrys because a lot washes in there, and I did probably about 5Ks, like 2.5Ks up and back. You know, I took a few photos over the last few days of like the dead cuttlefish and pufferfish, etc. It's just got increasingly worse, and you're starting to see that brown scum like we weren't seeing that to start with. I'd say 100-plus different, you know, fish and cuttlefish, a bit blown away, and it's a bit upsetting, to be honest.
Many locals have posted on social media about the number of dead animals they are seeing on beaches. Peter Heaslip says he was walking on Island Beach on Monday when he saw hundreds of dead worm-like creatures.
We go there two or three times a week, probably walking, and first thing I noticed was a lot of those worms seemed quite unusual. And then as we went along, we saw various other marine animals, including some fish, painted skates and things like that, particularly those worms. There were hundreds of them in the wash of the waves. Well, the actual creatures, I suppose, the skates and fish and that, probably a dozen, but the worms, hundreds. Yeah, it was quite alarming, really. It'd be interesting to be there at a lower tide and see if there was a lot more. And lots of other people have posted, I presume it's to do with that algae bloom.
Last week, South Australia's Environment Protection Authority identified microalgae Karenia mikimotoi, which is toxic to fish, as the cause of the bloom on the Fluorio Peninsula, where hundreds of dead sea creatures washed up at Encounter Bay and Basham Beach. Some people also reported sore eyes, blurry vision and coughing after visiting Waitpinga and Parson beaches before the department closed them. Dozens of dead kangaroos were also recently found near Tunkalilla Beach, which was also affected by the marine algae bloom. A Department of Primary Industries and Regions spokesperson says it has received a number of reports of dead fish washing up on Kangaroo Island and is investigating whether it is linked to the large-scale fish kill that occurred on the Fluorio Peninsula. The spokesperson said fisheries officers are monitoring environmental conditions and water samples had been collected for analysis. SA Health earlier told the ABC that Karenia mikimotoi was toxic to fish but not humans.
Vicky Natafalis with that report. Let's stay in South Australia now, where regional councils are making some noise about their slice of federal funding ahead of the upcoming election. Councils are calling for more local government funding for community facilities, tourism and infrastructure maintenance, claiming there's inequity in the way the federal government currently distributes money to regional councils. And they say they're being asked to do more with less. Renmark reporter Elise Arminini has been covering the story. Elise, what are South Australian regional councils claiming is wrong with the current funding arrangements?
Hi, Alex. Yeah, so a couple of councils here, Renmark, Purringa and Mid-Murray Council in particular, say that when it comes to the distribution of federal funding, South Australia is at a disadvantage. So it's quite an intricate system, and even people in council positions like CEO and Mayor still find it really hard to describe why they are disadvantaged. So my understanding is that a lot of money that council receives comes from ratepayers or from the federal government's financial assistance grants. So it's the distribution of these grants and the untied funding, which is funding that can be spent on any local issues or projects, so it's not tied to anything specific, that they say is not equal to their needs, especially when servicing regional communities.
In terms of the services that councils are worried about in regional towns, what's being affected? What are the flow-on effects?
So my understanding is it limits what council can actually use the money that they get from the federal government on. So councils might want to improve things like libraries or local infrastructure for tourism purposes, but the bulk of the grants that they do get ends up being spent on childcare or aged care or mental health services instead. And these were things that were previously overseen by the Commonwealth. So Heather Holmes-Ross, the president of the Local Government Association of South Australia, says that the formula for the Federal Financial Assistance Grants Program no longer reflects what councils do and the money that they need to do it.
It's really disappointing when we do see the other tiers of government expecting us to do more and then not funding us to do it, because the only ways we can get money is either through grants or through increasing rates. And communities have a limited capacity. They're suffering from cost of living crisis just like everyone else. And so it makes it tricky for councils to fund what they need to fund. We want all of our communities to have access to the things they need to thrive. If we could get a little bit more money from the state and the federal government and it could be distributed where the need is, that would be terrific.
So that was LGA SA President Heather Holmes-Ross there.
Elise, how does a town's population affect the federal funding model at the moment?
So the general purpose funding component is distributed on a per capita or population basis. Now, what's interesting is that submissions made to a parliamentary inquiry into local government sustainability last year have backed up the statements from local councils here that the distribution of that funding is not balanced. So one submission from the Grattan Institute said that the grants favour densely populated states, and similar-sized councils in different states received vastly different funding outcomes. Now, this is something that Tony Sivier, the Chief Executive Officer from Renmark Paringa Council, has highlighted when we spoke to him.
So Wentworth Shire Council has a population of roughly 7,500 people. Renmark Paringa has a population of 10,000, so we're roughly 2,500 people more, and we receive $2 million less in untied funding. So you can imagine how good that would be for us in terms of balancing our budget. And for, you know, a council that almost borders us, it's hard to explain and understand why we're so disadvantaged.
Renmark Paringa Council CEO Tony Sivier there.
And presumably for those regional councils delivering services in particularly remote areas, there are just a whole swag of additional challenges and costs.
For sure. A lot of the council money gets spent on things like roads and major infrastructure, so they can't focus a lot of that money like they would like to on things like those smaller community programs or libraries or, you know, just local roads even, because a lot of it goes to those state and council roads.
Have we also heard from members of the community about how they feel?
Yeah, we have. So I went out and spoke with a few people on the streets of Renmark here just about what they would like to see council spend more money on in their communities if federal funding and the model was changed to provide more to councils on the ground. So one person that was actually really happy to have a chat was 10-year-old Elsie Lindner from Renmark, and she just wanted to highlight the things that she had already thought about or noticed in her community here.
Adding in better sports facilities like fans, air conditioners or like scoreboards, because it's really hard to practice or play in there when it's really like hot or you can't keep up with the scores.
Have we heard from the federal government or from the opposition at this stage?
Yeah, so federal local government minister Christy McBain said that funding had increased, but mainly for the Roads to Recovery initiatives and a road safety initiative as well, and that transparent grant programs were available for housing and energy and growth opportunities, and that the responses from the inquiry would be used in future funding arrangements and decisions.
Elise, thanks so much.
Thank you, Alex.
Renmark reporter Elise Arminini there.
ABC Australia-wide.
And finally, we head to Taree on the New South Wales North Coast, where resident Rochelle Murray can be regularly spotted swimming laps at the local pool. Having had a stroke and emergency brain surgery, followed by a heart transplant about 18 months ago, Rochelle now has a new lease on life. Reporter Emma Siosian caught up with Rochelle poolside.
Feels so great to be back in the water. life is good. When your heart beats and oxygenated blood goes to the whole of your body and it's like, ah, I've got energy I've never even imagined. And I wonder what it would have been like in your 20s or your 30s. And it also makes you stop for that moment and think about where your heart came from.
As 63-year-old Rochelle Murray swims laps in her local public pool at Taree, she can breathe more easily than she has in a long time. She spent decades battling a rare congenital heart disease before receiving a life-saving heart transplant in October 2023.
So it's a genetic defect in the Lehmann AC gene, which is just one of the 32,000 genes or something that we have. And it just means that we wind up with cardiomyopathy with a conduction disorder, which means that our hearts can go really fast or really slow or whatever they feel like in the next 10 seconds when it changes around all the time. You're just inside your own life and your own head and your own body, and you don't really understand what it's like for other people. You kind of think that everybody else is kind of the same as you, until you start to go and do something, and say you're going on a walk up a hill or something and everybody's at the top of the hill and you're sort of, you know, like 10% up at the bottom, and you realise, oh, this is hard. Like, it's hard to do anything that's physical.
Less than 2 weeks before her heart transplant, Rochelle experienced a stroke and brain surgery.
I wasn't going to do this easily, so I had a really big stroke. Just by sheer chance, I was in Woolloomooloo in Sydney, down there to do a test for the hospital, and I was staying overnight, and I had the stroke in the motel, and I was staying with my cousin who fantastically was she's been a psychiatric nurse, but she kind of knew what to do, because I didn't, actually by the end I didn't know anything, I didn't know where I was, I don't recall any of that, and they took me to the hospital and they could remove the clot from the basilar artery in the back of my brain and from my left arm, and that sort of showed them that if I hadn't had that done, or if I'd had that happen up here in Taree, we might not be chatting today. At the time, you're not looking at the trauma. You're just trying to move on every second to the next bit. It isn't until later that you come back and you look at that, look at it from an external perspective and go, oh, wow, that was a lot to cope with.
It's been about 18 months since Rochelle had her heart transplant at Sydney's St Vincent's Hospital. She says at first her recovery was fairly intensely monitored, but things are starting to get easier and she's regaining her strength and feeling good.
At the beginning, it's kind of a steeper curve when it's just been implanted and you're probably still in hospital for like a couple of weeks. And they're watching you every day and, like, there's lots of blood tests involved. The testing starts to get less as time goes on. So it's tested every day, then every week, then every fortnight, then every month. And now I'm down to every 3 months, which is better because it's not so hard to get to Sydney.
Rochelle's experience has prompted her to be a strong advocate for organ donation. Two of her three sons have the same genetic heart condition.
So inside the family, it's also a bit odd because it's genetic, so we inherit it in essence from our family members before us, and we can give it to our children. So inside my family, I've got it from my dad, who got it from his mum. So I had it and didn't know when I had my children, and two of my three boys that I've given the condition to, so that's hard. I wouldn't be here if there wasn't an organ donor. You swim and you get to the end and you're not gasping for air and you think, oh, wow, is this what it feels like for people? And I've got the biggest smile and I can do things now I couldn't do before, and I feel fantastic, and I think, oh yeah, I can take my grandkids in to the water and go for a swim with them, and, you know, spending that time with your family and interacting and enjoying life. What a blessing. I chose early I was going to be tough, and I didn't know I was going to be set any challenges, but I'm always going to give it my best shot, and proof today, sitting out here, going for a swim and having a heart transplant. I can make it and other people can make it too.
Reporter Emma Siosian with that story. And that's Australia Wide for this Wednesday. My name's Alex Barwick. Have a lovely evening.
ABC Listen.